a science degree in planning from the University of Toronto and a PhD in urban economic geography from the London School of Economics. She's a registered professional planner and a member of the Canadian Institute of Planners. In her 20-year career as an urban consultant, her work has included reurbanization strategies and research, long-term regional growth planning, municipal economic development strategies, land use policies for industrial areas, and sustainability in the urban form, community design and infrastructure, and research on the impact of technology on the urban form. In 2010, she published the book Perverse Cities. Perverse refers to perverse incentives for you non-economists, if you're curious about the title, not to steal her thunder yet. And in this book, she makes the case that accurate pricing and better policy are fundamental to curbing sprawl. And she shows how this can be achieved in practice through a range of market-oriented tools that promote efficient, sustainable cities. So please join with me in welcoming her to York University. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. It's really nice to be here. I should preface this by saying I'm not an economist. I'm a planner. And I ended up writing this book, Perverse Cities, which you say it fast, it sounds like perversities, which is kind of what it's about. I ended up writing this book because of a lot of the planning work that I was doing. As Eric mentioned, there was quite a range. It had to do with long-range regional planning, community planning, and all of those plans and policies that I was working on, they all seemed to say the right things and hit all the right notes about sustainability and sustainable cities. And then, you know, they were adopted by various councils, and then I waited, you know, about 10 years or so to see the results and realized that, in my view, we weren't really getting the kind of cities that those plans described. We weren't really getting sustainable cities, and there really wasn't a whole lot of change going on. And so I started to try and figure out why that would be the case, given that we have a very sophisticated planning system, and it seemed to be doing all the right things and adopting, you know, policies by law and bylaw and all of those kinds of things. And yet, to me, the change on the ground was pretty minimal. So it wasn't because I had a real burning desire to, you know, figure out how you price, you know, phone networks. It was really because it occurred to me that this is a really important thing that's driving city development and urban form. And it's something that, particularly as planners, we're not really paying a lot of attention to. Now, maybe for urban economists, maybe they're a little more up to date on this and they know about it. But if they do know about it, they're not really pressing the case. And I think for the planners, people that are actually coming up with urban policy, it's really important to know about this. So that's why I ended up writing this book. So what I'm going to talk about today is a bit about what are the development patterns in cities, what's driving that, in particular looking at pricing, and then how we might go about fixing it, whether that's possible or probable. So again, when we look at planning policy, I'm going to focus on the Toronto area, the Greater Golden Horseshoe, because I think we all are pretty familiar with that. But planning policy is pretty consistent across Canada anyway. We always talk about things like complete communities, being able to do a lot of different kinds of activities, having a mix of activities and housing types within a particular community, about creating transit-supportive communities, walking, cycling, a greater emphasis on reurbanization and redevelopment rather than greenfields development, and where there is greenfields development, that it's more dense and more mixed. But when we look at what's really going on, well, first of all, there's not a whole lot of data to look at what's really going on, but here's some data which shows densities, which is really over time, so from core to older suburbs to newer suburbs. So you see that there's kind of falling density pattern. And then within the newer suburbs, here, move back. Within the newer suburbs, there's really not been a whole lot of change between 91 and 2001. It's more or less holding steady, and it's at about half the level of older suburbs that would have been built, say, in the 50s and 60s. And looking at greenfields and intensification, I'm sure you know that the places to grow strategy for the Greater Golden Horseshoe is considered pretty radical because it's setting a target of 40% intensification. So that means that 40% of all new housing units are supposed to be on land that's identified as already urban. It doesn't say anything about employment, which is a whole other issue, but that's a whole other lecture. So what this graph shows is what the actual number of units that are considered intensification are compared to greenfield. So the kind of taupe-colored part of the bar is intensification on already urbanized land, and the red is greenfields development. So you can see that there's kind of a variation from municipality to municipality, but overall, the levels are not really particularly high. And when you look at it on a percentage basis, so as a percentage of all units across different, these are just our, a selection of municipalities in the greater Golden Horseshoe, they tend to be around 15%. Brampton's down there at about 3%. Other places, like Mississauga, are higher, over 25%. And part of the reason for that is Mississauga's really running out of greenfields. So I think it's if that's true, that it's kind of sad that we only turn to intensification when there's no more greenfield land left to develop. Now, this is 2001 to 2006. The Places to Grow strategy came into place in 2006. And so it's been in place for a little more than 5 years now. And so hopefully we'll see that these numbers are changing. This is actually something that's been put up on the Places to Grow website. They're trying to show some early results or some early trends after Places to Grow. And this shows a change in housing units. So what they're saying is, well, we've actually now, since Places to Grow, got a lot more apartments and a lot less single-family dwellings. And so things are going well. Things are going according to plan. But when you look at the actual numbers behind that, really what's driving that is that there's been a fall in the total number of units in the second period. And in particular, the number of singles has gone way down, as have numbers of semis and rows. And apartments have increased a little bit. So it's not as if there's been a wholesale switch. It's just that singles and semis and rows have all gone down in terms of number. And then when you look at where those apartments are within the Greater Golden Horseshoe, well, about three quarters of them are in Toronto. They're mostly downtown Toronto, but in the city of Toronto. Then another maybe 15% or so are in the centers of Markham, Vaughan, and Mississauga. And then the rest are in other places in the Greater Golden Horseshoe. So it's very concentrated, in other words. The intensification and creation of apartments is really in a very few locations, and in particular, the City of Toronto. And when you look at what's happening on the ground, so this is a new development that's been built in the last few years. To my eyes, I don't see a whole lot of change here. This looks to me like a pretty auto-oriented, single-use kind of development. There's the classic collector road. Here's the local road. It's all single detached, low rise. There might be some semis in there. I'm not sure. Very automobile oriented. There's not really any sidewalk on that one side. You see there's a lot of cars around. This is in the middle of the day as well. So when people actually get home from work in their cars, I think you'll see a lot more cars than what are here at the moment. The one sort of change that I think has happened is that residential lots for grade-related dwellings have gotten smaller. So there's been a kind of densification there, but we're maintaining the same pattern and really just shrinking things down. And, we still have this very meticulous separation of uses. So if you live in that house and you want a sandwich, you have to get in your car and drive to the select sandwich. And here's the pedestrian environment. Is this what we're talking about when we're talking about creating walkable, bikeable communities? I don't think this particular pedestrian environment looks that enticing to me. And also the scale of development is very large, makes it very difficult in some cases to integrate employment. But here we have some, design issues. We have residential right behind retail, and yet, there's a wall built to separate the two uses. I'm not really sure why. So if you wanted to actually go to the restaurant that you see on the left there, you can't just, cut out the back. You have to go walk around in the curlicue and then get back. I'm not sure why the retail has to be segregated. So again, arterial road pattern, very car intensive. Here's, where you go for entertainment. And then looking at it from above, you get a really good sense of the pattern. So, we've taken out some of the green areas, I guess some of the river valleys. That wouldn't have been the case maybe 50 years ago. But again, you can see typical kind of curlicue pattern, some low density, and the very meticulous segregation of employment. So, on the right-hand side there, that's all the employment uses, and then all the residential is on the left. So you know, kind of goes without saying that when you're trying to get to work, you're not likely to be able to walk from your house to a place of employment. So then going back to the planning policies, you know, in my view, we're not really achieving these things. That, you know, we've had some very small improvements, but not really anything on the scale that we need in order to make our cities more resilient. Okay, so what's driving this? In other words, what's driving urban sprawl? When you look at the literature, the explanations tend to fall in a few categories. So on the demand side, people say it's just simply population growth or rising affluence. So when people get richer, they want larger lots. They want larger houses on larger lots. Falling transport costs or technology, new information technology that allows people to work at home, for example. On the supply side, planning itself has been criticized. So planning regulations or engineering regulations that require large lots, that require a lot of parking spaces, for example, that have maximum densities that limit density. Market failure is also, I'm sure, one that you're all well acquainted with, which is about the creation of non-priced externalities, like in the urban context, particularly congestion, maybe loss of farmland and open space, air pollution, greenhouse gas emissions, and so on, that these aren't priced and therefore promoting sprawl. And then finally, consumer preferences. There's an argument that's often made, particularly in the US, but also certainly in Canada amongst some groups, that this is simply what people want, and the market is just responding neutrally to consumer demand. I'm going to come back to that one. Okay, so here's how I started to think about it. We have urban development patterns, and they take place within the context of a planning framework and a market framework, but really they're about decisions. It's about people making decisions about property, you know, thousands and thousands of times a day. So it's, how do I travel? I'm going to buy a house. What kind of house? But these decisions are not really like, you know, buying a pair of socks. They have many dimensions to them. So it's about how much land, where is that land going to be, how much building do I need, how am I going to get there, what kinds of services are going to be available there, and what's the quality of those services. So all of these things together, just for simplicity's sake, are called urban goods and services. So they're a kind of package of things that really make up a property. When we make decisions about this, of course, a lot of it has to do with personal requirements. You know, I want a house where the school in the neighborhood is good for my kids. But prices play a very important role, and this is the thing that we really tend to neglect, at least in the planning world, we tend to neglect this, that people are not unaware or unaffected by prices. And what kind of prices are we talking about? So those urban goods and services around land and buildings and transport and other services are on the left, and the prices that shape those are really a range, again, reflecting those urban goods and services. So it might be the price of the property itself, the price of the building, a commercial rent. If you're buying a building, you have to think about what is the mortgage interest, how much is that going to cost, what is, you know, the cost of mortgage insurance, things like utility rates, you know, hydro, gas, user fees, property taxes, which are important. Transportation costs are also very important, although some people, I think, tend to neglect transportation costs because they're kind of ongoing rather than one big lump sum up at the front. But the other Eric Miller at University of Toronto, I don't know if you've seen some of the research he's done, he's actually quantified how the relationship between transportation costs and housing price changes, you know, as you go away from the center. And by the time you get into a suburban location, they're about equal. So it is a very important cost, which people, I think, tend to underestimate. So in other words, it's all a long way of saying that really prices play a very important role in driving urban development patterns. Okay, now if I were an economist, I would say that the cardinal economic rule is that price has to equal marginal cost. That's how you assume that you get economic efficiency and the efficient allocation of resources. But again, we're not really talking about a pair of socks here. We're talking about urban goods and services that have a spatial dimension. They take place over urban space in particular. And the cost of those urban goods and services is affected by urban form. And in particular, it's affected by these four aspects of urban form: the location. So, you know, where in an urban area is the urban good or service located? What is the density of development? What is the use? So that's, you know, is it residential? Is it commercial? Is it industrial, retail, and so on? And then what is the context? And by context, I mean a kind of small urban context. Is it in a walkable, mixed-use urban environment or not? And there's been a lot of research, you probably have covered it or will cover it, that looks at the relationship between urban format and infrastructure costs. So this is, these are, you know, the so-called cost of sprawl studies, of which there are many, many. This is just, I've just put the results of a few of them here on the on this table to show you what some of the results show. So the way you read this, if you look at roads, for example, on the bottom, there's a couple of studies there. And what they found is if you change urban form from a less efficient to a more efficient pattern, say a less dense to a more dense pattern, you can save between 25, say, and 60% in infrastructure costs for roads. And, you know, similar findings for other kinds of infrastructure. The results kind of depend. They don't ever really look exactly at the same kinds of infrastructure. Some include capital and operating, some don't. And they make different assumptions about what urban form you're moving from and to. So there's a range of results. But by and large, there's pretty compelling evidence that you can save a lot of money by having, on infrastructure, particularly network infrastructure, by having a more efficient urban form. Another way to look at this, and that's the way I've started to look at this, is that this is the amount of overspending. This is how much we're overspending on infrastructure as a result of not having an efficient urban form. This is some other research, so it applies not only to that kind of hard network infrastructure, but to things like mail delivery, for example, would apply to garbage pickup, street cleaning, some of those other operating services that take place across networks. So for economic efficiency, I've created this little commandment, which I'm sure the economists in the room will agree with, but when we're looking at urban goods and services, it's not just that the price has to reflect the marginal cost. It has to reflect the place-based marginal cost. That is, what is the cost of the service, delivering that service in that particular urban context. So this is my rule. Now, policies, public policies are playing an important role here in shaping prices for those urban goods and services, because urban goods and services are really either directly regulated or very strongly influenced by public policies. So those prices that we see on the left, we saw those before. Public policies, like the ones on the right, are really more or less determining how those prices are set. So this is things like a development charge, structures, a federal or provincial tax systems, mortgage policy, home ownership programs, infrastructure grants, utility pricing, a whole range of things that's really determining what those prices for urban goods and services are. And these policies are obviously in the public realm. So I'm just going to take you through a few examples here to show how this works. So this one is about development charges. Development charges, in case anybody doesn't know, are charges that a municipality charges developers for new development, and they're intended to cover the cost to the municipality of that infrastructure that's required to support that development. And they're charged, as I said, by the municipality, so they can be charged by two different municipalities. In the case of this example, I'm only showing the upper tier or regional municipal development charge. There's also a lower tier, but just for the purpose of illustrating this, I'm looking at the upper tier development charge. So this is an actual proposed house, and in this particular region, the development charge that it would face is $31,000, so it's a 30-foot lot. So that works out to about $1,000 per front foot. I should also say that for this development charge, really 100% of it is for network infrastructure. It's not for stuff that's not influenced by urban form, where the costs are not influenced by urban form. In that same municipality, you have a new suburban house also proposed. It's on a 60-foot lot. It faces the same $31,000 development charge. So, you know, when you do this sophisticated math, you can figure out that's $500 per front foot. So the question in my mind is, why are we charging the 60-foot lot at the same rate as we're charging a 30-foot lot? And when you look at it, for example, the actual cost for a 30-foot lot may be $20,000 for servicing. And the actual cost for a 60-foot lot may be $40,000. So in other words, you're overcharging the 30-foot lot by $10,000 and you're undercharging the 60-foot lot. So to me, this seems kind of backwards, because aren't we supposed to be actually encouraging the 30-foot lot and discouraging the 60-foot lot? And what we're doing here by having prices based on average costs across the type, or uniform cost for the development charge, we're really creating an incentive and subsidizing the 60-foot lot and creating a disincentive for the 30-foot lot. And this gets reflected ultimately in the price, the market price of the house as well, because the development charges are simply passed on to the final consumer in the final price of the house. I mean, the developers are not really going to be absorbing that cost themselves. This is some information that was part of a development charges study in the city of Ottawa. They thought, wouldn't it be a good idea to reflect how costs vary with location within the city? So they looked at what the actual development charge would be in different areas within the city of Ottawa. So what they found was, in the inner zone, that's inside the green belt, for those who are familiar with Ottawa, it would be about $10,000 per unit. And then in suburban areas, it would range, these suburban areas are all greenfields areas, the actual cost would range from about $15,000 to $25,000. So if they had put in a typical charge, which is average cost-based, it would have been $15,000. So again, you can see, well, for anybody who wants to build in the inner zone, they're going to be overcharged, you know, by that space between the top of the bar and the line, so about $10,000 per unit. And all of the suburban development is undercharged through an average cost development charge, you know, up to suburb 4, where it would be undercharged by about $10,000. So where does the $10,000 for the development in suburb 4 come from? Well, it comes from the overpaying in the inner zone. So the inner zone subsidizing the outer zone. And that only looks at location. If you looked at density, which also would come into play here, you find that those differences were even more pronounced. Ultimately, Ottawa adopted a two-zone system, so inside and outside the greenbelt. So it ended up, I'm not sure if this might be updated now, but basically ended up being around $14,000 inside the greenbelt and $23,000 outside. Okay, so this is these are two different developments in the same municipality again. The one on the left, on the top left, is just an aerial view of that apartment building, and a new low-rise suburban, mostly single, detached development on the right.
In Ottawa?
This is not in Ottawa. This is in Hamilton. So can anybody guess what the similarity or the what these two things have in common? Yeah.
The same development charge overall?
Yes. Very good. Yeah, so they pay the same development charge. So that little sort of irregular squiggle there, that's the lot area of the development on the left, sort of superimposed. So the question is, you know, why would you pay the same development charge for these two different kinds of development? The development charge is about $5 million in both cases, so it's not an insignificant amount. But I think you start to get to the idea that it's not really reflecting how costs vary. And the reason is because when they figure out how to set the level of the development charge, it's really just based on the number of people. So they figure out what the cost is going to be and they divide it by the number of people. Then they say, oh, well, apartment has, you know, 1.5 people per unit. That's how much we're going to charge that kind of building. And then a single detached house has 3 people, and that's how we're going to charge that. They do not take how the costs vary with urban form into account at all. Okay, so another example here, property tax. It's the same kind of situation. You have a downtown residential building. It ends up paying about $100 per front foot for property tax. And I've taken out, you know, what you would pay normally for network services, the network services portion of the property tax. Then you have a suburban lot, 54 feet wide, and there they end up paying about $33 per front foot. So this might make sense to have the urban pay at a rate really three times higher than the suburban if the costs were actually three times higher in the urban area. But on a per front foot basis, it's not likely that that's the case. It's likely that the costs are very similar. So the economic problem here is not one about average costs as it was with development charges, but here the prices charged, in this case the property tax, are just completely unrelated to cost causation. There's no relationship whatsoever because they're based on the market value assessment. It's how much the property is worth, not how much cost causation is associated with the different forms of development in different locations. So again, we also get this kind of implicit cross-subsidy from the more efficient, higher-priced to the less efficient, lower-priced housing. And finally, with respect to parking, surface parking in particular, well, the price there is zero a lot of the time. But we all, I think, can understand that it's actually not cost-free, that it actually does, there are costs associated with building and maintaining parking spaces. And these are estimated at about $1,000 to $2,000 per annum per space. So that's things like lighting and security and cleaning and snow plowing and everything. So here the problem, the economic problem, is one that there is no apparent pricing. Parking seems to be free. But it's not really free because you have to pay that $1,000 to $2,000 per year per space somehow. So it gets put in the price of the rent. For example, if we're talking about a mall, it would be included in the commercial rent. And then, of course, it's passed on to consumers when they buy goods and services from the mall. And so you still get a cross-subsidy there. If you go to the mall and you don't park, then you're subsidizing people who go to the mall and who do park. And from an urban sprawl point of view, I think this is very important because parking is a huge physical component to urban sprawl. It's probably the biggest physical component to urban sprawl. So the fact that we don't price parking is a big issue with respect to trying to get more compact development patterns. So I went through a lot of examples in the book in a very kind of long, tedious way, explaining how all these different kinds of pricing mechanisms don't really reflect costs in an urban context. And I came out with about six sort of different kind of categories of misincentive and mispricing. So we've seen three or four of them already. And the other ones have to do with sometimes the way policies are developed and infrastructure and direct subsidies, which I won't talk about today. Why do we care? Well, if we go back to my little model here about prices shaping development patterns, I think it's obvious by now that the prices are not really reflecting costs accurately within an urban context. So we're taking away the ability for accurate price signals to influence decisions so we get efficient outcomes. So for example, if you have uniform development charges, if you're a developer and you're looking at building, you know, a development somewhere, and the development charge that you face is the same no matter where you build, then obviously you're not really going to care what the actual cost is because you don't have to take that into account. So in a municipality, you might have even different greenfields developments that have very different costs attached to them, as we saw in Ottawa, for example. Some greenfields were way more expensive than others. But the developer doesn't really care about that because he's going to pay the same development charge no matter if he builds in an expensive area or a not-so-expensive area. So we get a lot of distortions, and then, of course, that affects the urban development patterns that we get. Then at a kind of broader level or higher level, well, fundamentally what this means is that we have a set of price signals that are providing artificial incentives to urban sprawl and disincentives to the more compact, mixed, denser, and more efficient kinds of urban development patterns that all of the planning documents say that we're trying to achieve. So the two things are working at cross purposes. We have these powerful financial incentives that are really kind of undermining the planning policy, directly contravening planning policy and planning objectives. And so, of course, that weakens the impact of planning policy. And then we get inefficient development patterns as a result. And when we have inefficient development patterns, that is lower density, less reurbanization than we would otherwise have, we get overspending on infrastructure. So that 20 to 60% of overspending on infrastructure can be directly linked to the price signals or the mispriced signals that we're creating. And of course, there's an opportunity cost to that as well, because if we're spending an extra 20% to 60% on simply having more kilometers of road and sewer and water and conduit, you know, what is the productivity of that compared to how we might otherwise invest that 20% to 60% savings? I mean, I personally can think of other ways, like bike paths or district energy or community centers, different ways of reinvesting that might actually return greater results to the community than simply having some more kilometers of road outside your house. And of course, you know, there are these implicit cross subsidies. So within each of these price mechanisms, whether it's utility pricing or property tax, there are cross subsidies happening. And these are not really apparent, I don't think. I think people who may be subsidized by development charge or those that are doing the subsidizing, I don't think they're really aware that this is going on. So somebody who buys a relatively small house in a municipality, I don't think they're really aware that they're subsidizing the choice of somebody else who bought a larger house on a larger property. And of course, this has impacts for affordable housing, because affordable housing tends to be on the more efficient end of the spectrum. I mean, affordable housing doesn't usually take the form of a single detached house on a 60-foot lot. It tends to be, you know, smaller apartments, townhouses, often in marginal urban areas. And these are precisely the kinds of development that get overcharged through these various mechanisms. And then finally, getting back to this idea that I mentioned about why we have sprawl. So I think it's probably clear by now what I'm going to say here. You know, the argument that we have sprawl because people are simply, developers are simply responding to market demand, and this is what the market demands. Well, it's what the market demands within this current price landscape that we have. But that price landscape is very distorted by these policies, and it's very distorted in favor of less efficient development and against more efficient development. So when faced by that price landscape, yes, people might actually want, you know, more low density. But if they faced a price landscape where the prices actually reflected the costs, I think they might make different decisions. Okay, so how would we go about fixing this? I won't go into this in a lot of detail, but I'll just give you a couple of examples. So the way that we have to fix it, I think, is you have to fix the policies that are misshaping the prices. So we have to attack those public policies that are doing the distorting. And we have to create, for those public policies around urban goods and services, prices that actually reflect variations in cost related to those factors that influence cost. So again, related to location, density, use, and context. So do the prices actually reflect costs as they vary with those factors? And then secondly, are the prices transparent? Because people need to know what they are in order to respond to them. They have to be visible. So a development charge, if it's still buried in the price of the house, may not be so visible, even if it's accurate. So one thing you might do, for example, is charge the development charge separately. You know, like when you buy a new house, you know, do you want the granite countertop, yes or no? Do you want the extra 10 feet of road outside of your house? Well, that will cost you an extra, you know, $10,000 or whatever the case may be. And I think if it became apparent and the costs were apparent, people would, an example of how people would maybe start to make different decisions when they realize how much it actually costs. I should just say also, development charges can be a lot of money. So in places like York Region or Markham, which I'll show you in a minute, you know, you can get up to maybe $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 per unit in some of the suburban municipalities around Toronto paying for infrastructure. Okay, so this is a typical development charge. We saw this earlier. There's a lot of problems with it. Here's how they've dealt with it in Markham. So town of Markham is the poster city for development charges. They're trying to do something different in the town of Markham. I don't know if you know about some of the things that are going on there, but there's a lot of new urbanist developments. They're trying to create compact, transit-oriented, new suburban downtowns, more or less from greenfields. And they've actually put in place a development charge system that is area-based. So as you can see here, it varies according to the area within the town. And you can see, again, there's a pretty big variation in what the costs are. The high costs are for Markham Centre, where they're attempting to build much more densely. So there are higher costs there. But the idea is that because you're building a lot more densely, that you have higher revenues and that can actually cover the costs. The other thing that's interesting here, it's on a per net hectare basis. So it's not on a per unit basis. So to me, this makes a lot of sense because when you have a charge, say it's $100,000 per land area, per hectare, you're building in incentive to densification. So you can either build a lot on that hectare or little. If you build a lot, you can spread the cost. If you build a little, you're not. But you're going to cover the cost no matter what, and there's an inherent incentive to densify. A typical non-residential development charge is based on this per square foot, a floor area basis. So again, here you have a built-in disincentive to densification because the more floor area you build, the more you pay. So this actually, and this is pretty typical across, this kind of charge, pretty typical across Ontario. So it doesn't actually reflect any of my factors of that affect urban, urban form factors that affect costs. So you could just simply restructure this so that you figure out, you know, how do the costs vary from zone to zone within a particular place? How do they vary according to use? Like retail is probably more than manufacturing for certain kinds of services. And then do it on a per hectare basis. So I guess the point is simply that, you know, really what's required is doing some different calculations and then printing those out on, you know, on a piece of paper and putting it up on your website. You have a different kind of regime for charging. But not many places actually do this. There's examples here and there. So this is York Region. They do it for roads. So you can see some of the developers in York Region who don't build retail figured out that it was actually the retail development that was causing all the traffic. So the developers who built industrial and office and institutional launched an appeal so that they wouldn't have to pay the same charge. And as you can see, it's about three times higher for retail because they just generate that many more trips than do the other kinds of non-residential. Okay, here's my one slide on how you fix property tax. You know, in the short term, you know, what I'm trying to think of here, particularly when I talk to municipalities, is what can you do, you know, that's practical and in the short term. And one of the things you can do is to take those network services off the property tax and charge a user fee for them and have that user fee reflect urban form factors like location and density and so on. And there's, you know, precedent for doing this. You know, garbage has been taken off in Toronto, for example. We have a separate garbage charge now, although they didn't reduce the property tax. When they did that, they just kind of added it on. Kitchener has recently adopted what I think is a beautiful charge for stormwater, where the amount you pay is based on how much impervious area you have on your lot. And they, I think, have started to introduce a system of credits so that if you actually reduce the amount of imperviousness on your property, you pay a lower charge. So to me, that is the perfect thing because the prices, you know, capture the costs, they pay for the costs, and also there's a very clear signal to people about if you have a lot of paving on your property, that actually makes things more expensive, so you're going to pay more. You could do the same thing with very simple user fees, so taking the road costs off property tax and putting them on a user fee in very simple ways. And parking, to me, the main thing about parking is to use an economic solution rather than an engineering solution, so an economic solution being some form of parking pricing, which is done in a lot of places. And even in Canada, we have some now in Montreal and Vancouver have recently adopted parking taxes. There's a huge range of opportunities here. And I don't know if any of you know Donald Shoup's book, The High Cost of Free Parking, which is a great book. And it's about 700 pages just on parking pricing. So if you're into it, that's the book to get. Here's an example where they did it recently in Nottingham, for example, small city. They're reinvesting in transit. So just to conclude, you know, where I end up on this is that the reason we have sprawl, sadly or otherwise, is because of public policy. It's a public policy issue, and particularly the mispricing. And if we really want to get at changing that urban development pattern, we really have to deal with the mispricing issue. And there are ways to do it. That would allow you, or allow the planning policy and the pricing strategies to work together and support each other. And to me, if you align those two things, the planning policy would be that much more, a lot more effective than it is now. I think I'll stop. This is a thing, Wilbur Thompson figured this out a long time ago.
Eric, I guess you would also take on the discussion, Lee?
We have time for questions, comments, and so on.
Question. What you said about the parking, how it's not priced, do you mean that there's no property taxes paid for it?
No, what I mean is when you go to, if you have surface parking, typically, particularly in suburban areas, when you go to park your car, you don't usually pay.
The user doesn't pay?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. There's no real user fees, yeah.
So in your one of your last slides, when you say the solutions for parking, you mean like individually charging for parking?
Well, there's a range, you know, there's a wide range of solutions for parking. One of the ones that I think is good, and a few cities in Australia, they have a parking levy, so the municipality charges a levy on every surface parking space per year. So there's an additional parking tax, and then they use that. It's like as if you had a road toll, for example, except applied to parking. And then they use that to reinvest in transit, to create transit. So there's a number of ways of dealing with surface parking. I think even if you had, you know, on private parking where you had, say, over a certain number of surface lots, if you were required to charge parking, or else the municipality would charge an additional parking tax. So that might be something that would create an incentive for providers, private sector providers, to charge parking taxes. I think that would make a huge difference in terms of people's behavior, even if it's not a lot of money. You know, because I think once there's even a price signal, even if it's, you know, just you have to pay a quarter or something, just people, I think, start to react to that, and that way you might be able to ration parking spaces and reduce the need for parking spaces. Because what happens now is we have unlimited demand because there is no pricing, there's no kind of rationality, price rationality brought to bear, and the way we solve it is by simply building more parking spaces. But to me, it seems better to put a price on it, rationalize the demand, and then reduce the amount of parking spaces required, and then in so doing might be able to create development opportunities at the same time. And so that seems like kind of changing the cycle around to a different pattern.
Just wondering, along those lines, do developers actually pay a development charge for parking spaces built, or do property owners pay sort of property tax on parking spaces that are on their property?
The development charge doesn't relate to parking spaces.
Okay.
That might be another alternative, you know, to if you pay by the space, you know, there's an additional charge. But the way it stands now, no, it's typically it's just on either the gross floor area if it's non-residential, or based on the kind of unit if it's residential. And there's it's completely oblivious to the number or kind of parking spaces, whether it's above ground, below ground. The development charge doesn't really take that into account.
So in the case of the malls, the example that you were giving, the cost of parking is basically reflected in the rent for the store owners, and that's passed on to the consumer.
Right. And if you were building a new mall, you would pay a development charge based on what is the floor area of the mall, of the built area of the mall, not,
right,
you know, on the area of the parking.
So I guess that should be an incentive to build a smaller mall with more parking.
Yeah, except they always want to build a lot of parking because they want people to be able to come and park without having to look for a space. But that would be a good idea, I think, actually. I mean, that would be one way. I mean, there's so many ways you can deal with this, but I think if you actually did charge, particularly if you have large surface parking, because that's what's generating trips. So you could argue that, you know, for at least the road portion of the development charge, that it could be tied to how many parking spaces you have. That might be one way of doing it. Yeah?
I just have a small question. On one of the slides at the beginning, it was what is driving urban sprawl.
Mm-hmm.
And under the list for demand, one of the things was falling transportation costs.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering how that works, because in my mind, I might just be missing something.
Mm-hmm.
But it would seem that transportation costs.
Oh, that just means over time.
Okay.
Over time, not
over time.
Yeah,
okay.
Not over space.
Okay.
Uh-huh. So, I mean, that's something that's just quoted in the research. So in the long term,
so since
cars have gotten cheaper.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. And
yes, I think it has, but then cars are more fuel efficient. So I think in the long term, like they're talking about probably over, five decades or so, yeah, that transportation costs have been falling. You look perplexed. Maybe it's not true anymore. Maybe it's turned out. I'm not sure. Like when I think they're thinking of, when you compare to say the 60s and 70s, in the long term, costs have been falling. And there are also, subsidies around that as well. One of the big ones actually, which I've come across recently, is that in Ontario, the province removed sales tax from automobile insurance premiums. So when you go to pay your automobile insurance, you don't have to pay sales tax on it. And that actually costs the province $1 billion a year in foregone tax revenue and that's basically a subsidy to drivers, car drivers. Yeah?
With regards to the Markham example, I think you said that for development near to the urban center, you said that it was actually more expensive.
Yeah.
But I would think that maybe you would want that to be less expensive to encourage more density in the center and to improve sort of the opportunity for public transit and things like that.
Yeah, see, in Markham, it's kind of unusual because they're building downtown from greenfields. It's going immediately from greenfields to downtown. And so when you do that, when you're building more densely from a greenfield situation, the costs are actually higher for infrastructure. And what they're doing is, I believe, that the costs are really just accurately represented in the development charges that they're charging. But because they're building higher density and it's already pre-zoned for high density, you get a lot more revenue. Like it's much more valuable, and there's a lot more revenue associated with the high density, and so the high density can actually cover the costs. Now, if you're in an already built-up urban area, often you have development capacity within the already urbanized area, where factories have closed down or there, people have left, and you have development capacity there, and it is cheaper because you can make use of existing roads, existing sewer and water networks and so on, and the marginal cost is very low. And so there, the cost should be a lot lower. And often they're not. Often, you pay the same price, whether it's greenfields, where development has to be serviced from scratch, or in an already urbanized area where all of the existing services are in place and the marginal cost is very low. So Markham is a bit of an unusual situation because they're trying to create this downtown more or less from greenfields right to downtown.
So if it wasn't Markham we were talking about, if it was Toronto, for example, you would want to sort of reverse those incentives?
Yeah, I think if you looked at somewhere, say, like Brampton, or somewhere that has older areas and greenfields, you'd want to charge, where it reflected the variation costs. And Brampton doesn't. In fact, most places that are like that, they don't reflect the cost. Ottawa is another example. That's one municipality. And so it does to a certain extent. But I actually think in Ottawa, because they adopted that two-zone system, so they more or less have inner and greenfields. But the inner is very, very big. And I think there's greenfields and a lot of suburban area within the inner. And if they had sort of finessed that a bit more and had a central zone, maybe a three-zone system, you would have found that the costs in the central zone were even lower still. So it's better than most, but still not perfect. Yeah.
I know the city of Oshawa is trying to reduce development charges substantially for brownfield sites, but that's because they have a lot of brownfield sites in the center.
Right. So. What often happens, though, as well, is that, again, because if a municipality has the kind of conventional development charge, they're already subsidizing the very low density greenfields development through the development charge because it's underpriced. And then they say, why aren't we getting the density around transit stations? Why aren't we getting more development in the center? And they don't realize it's because it's already being overcharged and the other stuff is undercharged. So then they say, okay, well, now we have to, let's eliminate the development charge around transit stations, say. But to me, if they actually got the prices right to begin with, they wouldn't have to do that. If they do that, then they're subsidizing development around transit stations and subsidizing development at greenfields, which, you know, to me that really makes no sense. I think it makes sense to kind of start with a tableau where each kind of development pays its actual costs. And then if you still need to create a subsidy, which you might for brownfields because there's additional costs associated with brownfields, or if an area is particularly depressed, then you can decide to create a subsidy. But to start off with a very wonky kind of price landscape and then kind of start tinkering with that even more because you need to, because it's not accurate to begin with, seems a little bit perverse to me. Yeah.
I'm just thinking that there, I think there's kind of a political dimension to what you're talking about here, in the sense that when I think of like carbon taxes or road tolls or I don't know, just the price we pay for energy in terms of conservation, things like that, people have really resisted efforts to try and make the prices really fit better with the cost. And so I guess my question is, do you think that some of the things that you're suggesting in terms of, say, development charges are more acceptable somehow to people politically than something like a carbon tax or tolls?
I think that's a really great question. I think they are more politically acceptable, and I think they're different to a certain extent from, say, a carbon tax, because carbon is not really priced, at least the emissions component of carbon is not really priced right now. All of the things I'm talking about are things that are currently priced. We already are paying for this infrastructure, and we're paying for it through different kinds of price mechanisms, whether it's, you know, fees or property taxes or development charges. We're already paying for it. And I guess the point that I was trying to make is that we need to pay for it in a different way. So it's not like we're adding on a charge for something that wasn't charged for before. It's just that we have to change the way that we price it. Now, if you were to do that, so say if you were to actually create a development charge that actually reflected how the costs vary, you know, according to density and location, you would get a probably fairly significant recalibration of prices. So the, you know, the prices for the stuff that's currently subsidized, the less efficient stuff, would go up. And the price for the more efficient stuff, like things that are on smaller lots or in central areas, would go down. So there'd be a bigger differential between those two kinds of prices. And to me, that's really fundamental to, you know, shifting the demand. So can you do that politically? I think you can. I think you have to be smart about it. I think you have to do it in a way that allows people to make decisions to save money, like you can with the Kitchener. That's one of the reasons I thought the Kitchener charge was so good, because, first of all, it creates the link between the price and the cost, but then it also allows people to save money. In the short term, they can save money by reducing the amount of impervious area. And if you take that off the property tax and then reduce the property tax and put it on a user charge, so much the better. I think the other thing that you can do is, when people become more aware of these kinds of cross subsidies, particularly the people that are on the paying end, might become more vocal and resistant to you know, paying more than the cost that they're actually incurring and thereby subsidizing other people's choices. So I think there's potential for some political organization around that particular issue. And I think you have to of course, you know, particularly as it affects people who are already in place. So with respect to property tax, phase it in over a long period of time. Something like development charges, that's only new development, right? That's people haven't made the choice yet to live in a particular place. So I think that's one of the reasons, I guess, why I talk more about development charges, because it just seems like it's relatively easy to do and would have a big impact, you know, right away. Yeah.
Yeah, are you thinking of re-reflecting the taxes? I think this is all about re-reflecting. Taxes to control sprawl or to reflect it in the right terms, like to reflect the true cost or to reflect to discourage the sprawl? Because you just said that you want to reduce brownfield development. Like if you subsidize brownfield development, that's a kind of mispricing again. So if you're taking it as a tool to reduce sprawl, that is a different case.
I think if you get the prices right, you will reduce sprawl. And that doesn't mean, though, that there aren't cases where you might also want to provide a subsidy. Like there, it doesn't mean that there's never a rationale for providing a subsidy. It's just that situation now, we're providing subsidies all over the place, but there's no real rationale for it. It's just kind of evolved that way over time for whatever reason. So I think, there are certainly a lot of cases where you might want to provide a public subsidy, where there's a public benefit and where something isn't going to be realized. So public transit, obviously, is something where you need to provide a subsidy because it's not going to happen if it's just left to the private sector. Brownfields is another example there where there are additional costs of cleanup that maybe the market can't bear. So you might want to, be able to deal with those costs and then let the market take over. So I think it's both. I think if you get the true costs right, you will, as a byproduct, reduce sprawl. Yeah.
So you have been, seeing politicians and developers and people in charge of making these kind of decisions. What was their perception of it? What is the willingness? What is the political climate around your argument in Ontario?
Well, I'll have a better idea of that next week. I'm meeting with Municipal Affairs and Housing. We'll see how. I guess they're interested, so that's good. That's a good sign. Different municipalities show different levels of interest. I think some places like Hamilton, for example, some of the people there get it and they understand, and particularly when it gets around to budget time. So they understand how this can increase a municipality's costs, both in the short term and long term, and I think if they can find a way out of that, that's very appealing to them. And when, for example, in Hamilton, that was an example where they were thinking of eliminating the development charge in a certain part of the city, in the older part of the city, while they were still subsidizing through the development charge greenfields. And when they realized that that's what was going on, they thought, oh, well, maybe we should just rethink the development charge rather than now reducing our revenue by eliminating the charge. In the inner part of Hamilton, we might be able to get a better revenue situation if we actually just have the right charge. So it takes some convincing because, first of all, people are not naturally drawn to this topic. But I think the environmentalists are, and for municipalities, when they realize what the implications are for revenue, short-term and long-term, then they find it much more interesting.
How would you think that the City of Toronto would perceive it, the regime in power?
Well, that's a car-based group, so I think anything that would increase costs for suburban development in the outer part of Toronto and people that drive cars is not going to be very popular amongst the political people there. But interestingly, the person from Markham, who developed the system in Markham, has moved to City of Toronto and is now deputy manager of the City of Toronto. So why he did that, I'm not sure, but we'll see. Maybe, because he's the person behind that system, so we'll see if something happens in the City of Toronto or Israel. I don't know.
Yeah, just to think about this pricing mechanism from the perspective of affordability. Now, the context is people are moving to suburbs. I know there could be different other reasons, but one reason is price, I have to say. So you start thinking about the condition when people your idea gets implemented and then suburbs starts to become expensive. So at the same time, I know that will be artificial or natural, the housing market, the prices of hard housing market in the city core will also go up. So how do you think your idea will match with the, don't conflict with the people who don't have, whose affordability will be affected? You know what I mean?
Well, the people whose affordability would be affected.
Because now people are going outside because they can afford it. Now, if that's expensive, mm-hmm. they want to go they will only come inside, but that's not going to happen. Like center of city certainly will have more resources, more facility, so it will be, I don't know how that happened. Like how we can imagine that center of city being cheaper than...
It's not going to be cheaper in absolute terms, you know, because you still have a land market where it's still going to be more expensive, you know, in central, denser locations. But instead of having a gradient that's like this, you might have a gradient that's, you know, like that. But it's not going to be, you know, complete reversal. You're still going to be dealing with just a portion of the prices. But that might be enough to shift the demand, you know, to a certain extent away from, like a portion of the demand away from the less efficient development into more efficient development. And, you know, frankly, as long as you get the prices right, like if somebody wants to live on a 60-foot lot, you know, personally, I don't really care as long as they pay the actual cost associated with that. And I think from a municipality's point of view, that's important as well, that the cost is actually covered. But I think if you did do that, you'd have a lot less demand for the 60-foot lots. You'd still have some demand. And some people are not so sensitive to price. And that, to me, that's fine. But I think the relative amount of 60-foot lots compared to, say, 30-foot lots, even in suburban areas, there'd be a shift.
So it's... this is 330, this is a quick question. Well, maybe you conclude on that question.
No, I was just wondering, I guess, from a technical perspective, how you would propose calculating the actual costs for the new model of development charges, whether that would be based on the actual cost that each housing unit would incur in servicing, or the neighborhood, or the zonal system?
There's a lot of ways to do it. What I suggested in the slideshow is you would look at the zones first, so you would identify where the big variations were, and you know, engineers know that. And then I would allocate it for network infrastructure on a per hectare basis, so on a land area basis, not on a per unit basis. But there's a lot of different ways of doing it. In some places in BC, they do it based on the zoning category, which is also related to density and location to a certain extent, but, you know, so they've tied it to their zoning code. But there's, you know, there's a lot of different ways.
Great. Well, thank you. Sorry to cut off for the discussion.
We've accepted tokens from all of us here in
thank
the room and also from all of us here at York. Thanks again for coming.
It's my pleasure.
All the best, and all the best, I guess, for all of us in the future in terms of making cities less perverse than they are today.
Thank you. Thank you.